Live from Burbank, California, recently redistricted in favor of hamburgers. It's the Mark Maron Show. And now, hold the lettuce. Mark Maron.
Oh, boy. This is real show business now. We'll see how show business works. Good evening, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives, and, of course, you pain sponges and need machines. How are you? It's Friday. I think we're going to try to have some fun. I feel fun in the air. I am ecstatic about a couple of things. Let me set up the show first because I sometimes forget to do that. I want to deny you good people. Joel Rubin from the LA Times is going to come in. No, he's not coming in. I'm going to get him on the phone and I'm going to educate myself about the issues around what Jonathan Alter brought up the other night because I knew that I didn't know what I was talking about when it came to the teachers union's comments from the other day. As you will recall, Jonathan Alter said that the teachers unions are to the Democratic Party what the religious right is to the Republican Party, and it's about accountability, that there's no way that the Democrats can be accountable, held accountable, or be considered accountable, or people responsible if they are aligned with the teachers' unions. That's what he implied, I think. So there was an issue here yesterday in L.A. where Mayor Villaraigosa, Antonio Villaraigosa, was able to cut a deal or get voted a bill through by the local legislature here to take a lot of control over L.A.'s public schools. And there's an agreement that has been made with the teachers union. There's been dissent on this, and the implications are a question of accountability, and it's kind of convoluted and I don't understand it. So we're going to get a non-partial journalist to try and show both sides of this, because this is happening in other states. There's been some discussion on the blog about whether or not this is a move towards ridding the federal government of the Department of Education. There is an issue as to, you know, whether the teachers' unions are right or wrong, whether the charter schools are an obstruction to their cause. There's a lot of questions I don't know the answers to. Couldn't wrap my brain around it. We're going to talk to Joel Rubin. All right, Peter Horton, the guy who used to be on 30-something who now directs television shows, appeared in the movie Who Killed the Electric Car. He's one of the first electric car owners. And in the film, you actually see him sad-eyed as his electric car is taken away on a truck. So we're going to talk to him because that movie opens momentarily. Tonight, when? I don't know. We'll find out. It's on paper somewhere. Vic Garbarini, Uncle Vic, is back with Vic's Picks. We're going to be talking about Wolf Mother, the band. We're going to be talking about the Raconteurs, that's Jack White's band. And we're going to be talking about Arctic Monkey, which I didn't like. I like the other two. Mike and Patrick Henry, former writers for The Family Guy, are now the creators of KickedInTheNuts.com. So we're going to raise the dialogue a little bit. And Eddie Pepitone, I don't even know what he's doing, but he's here, and I'll bet you it involves screaming. Jim, I do think that there is something to be excited about, though. There's a couple of things to be excited about. This Supreme Court ruling is a profound kick in the ass to the George Bush's administration. It is a profound example of checks and balances, you know, raising its tired head, and the Supreme Court basically saying, who the hell do you think you are to George Bush and Dick Cheney and their ideas of government? The court found that the military tribunals that really haven't been put into play or defined. But these guys were looking for a way to align themselves, the neocon death cult, with the military to basically run a covert justice system within the military that had very little rules or definitions and would allow them to just say, we've heard you're bad, so you're going to be detained for the rest of your life. Based on, we heard you were bad because after we hung you upside down and, you know, hooked electrodes to your and kicked you in the head and had dogs, you know, growl at your genitals, you admitted to being a terrorist, so we're going to lock you up because that is good for us. So the court found that the tribunals, quote, were not authorized by any act of Congress and that their structure and procedures violate the Uniform Code of Military Justice and the four Geneva Conventions. And this is amazing because the Bush administration, there's never been a more unconstitutional administration than this one. And their interpretation of what executive power is, which is, you know, swear to secrecy and do whatever the hell you want and change the rules as you go along if you need to. This is Cheney's plan. This is the first profound action against this. And this is what the Supreme Court's for. It's an amazing thing that this court, and everyone was sort of panicky about the Supreme Court, made this amazing ruling in the name of democracy, in the name of checks and balances, in the name of protecting our governmental system. you know, whether they'll continue that trend, I don't know. What's that?
So what's going to happen to Gitmo now? Are they going to pay fines or something?
Well, I think that, that's now there's just a terrorism fine. And apparently, yeah, if you're suspected terrorist, you get a ticket. And they cite you depending on the scope of the problem. And then you can fight it in court and then maybe get off. No, I think what they're going to do, this is going to bring more attention to the fact that it needs to be closed down. And these guys need to, they've got to figure out a way to process these to either charge them, you know, and process them through the legal system that we have in place, or let them go. They're just going to have to accept that that's the way it is. Let me just read some of this stuff. That apparently the military tribunal system is a form of military trial that has not been used since World War II. And rather than structuring the military tribunals on a general court-martial, that's the way they usually handle it, which is a proven method by which the military conducts trials, the administration sought to design a new system from scratch. And apparently this system was erratic, it was fragmented, it could rely on hearsay, coerced testimony, unsworn statements, as I said, and they have not successfully tried a single person to this day with this system. And in this Supreme Court ruling, Rumsfeld versus Hamdi, what we have here, the ruling on Wednesday declared that, quote, a state of war is not a blank check for the president. And John Paul Stevens, a justice, John Paul Stevens wrote, there is nothing in the text or legislative history of the authorization for the use of military force, even hinting that Congress intended to expand or alter the laws already governing the treatment of military detainees in the Geneva Conventions, which we are signed on to. Because the Bush is saying, hey, Congress signed off on this. They signed off on this, man. It was when they voted to authorize the use of military force, we can do whatever the hell we want. We can tap your phones. We can have military tribunals. It just opens the door for us to react any way we decide to react because this is a time of war. And basically these guys, the Supreme Court said, no, that is not true. The Congress did not imply that. We still have to honor the Geneva Conventions. We have to, you know, work within the international law of combat and of how to handle detainees. And this is a big kick in the ass to all of it, to them rationalizing torture, to wiretaps. This throws into question the constitutionality from the Supreme Court. This throws into question the constitutionality of all of these acts they have taken that have stunk of transgressions of the Constitution. It's very exciting. And apparently, if I can look to this right here, in the ruling, Common Article 3 of the Geneva Convention applies to the detention of the guy in question, this guy Hamdan. The Supreme Court has rejected the administration's fundamental shift away from more than a century of U.S. military practice of applying international humanitarian law to armed conflict. In addition to guidelines on fair trials, Common Article 3 prohibits, quote, violence to life and persons, in particular murder of all kinds, mutilation, cruel treatment, and torture, and outrages upon personal dignity, in particular humiliating and degrading treatments. So this just says, all of it's wrong, you're wrong. Now, if Bush thinks he's going to go back to Congress and get this all okayed again, which is fine, because now the court has made their decision. So now George Bush is forced to behave like a Democratic president and go back to Congress on specifics and ask them to re-legislate and re-vote on his ideas. And maybe now that his approval ratings are in the 30s, some of these guys will have the nads to reassess their own personal commitment to the Constitution and make a different decision around these issues as they come up. It's a good thing. It's a good thing to see this president get kicked in the ass, I believe.
Or the nuts.
Yeah, kicked in the nuts, because we're going to have the guy from kickedinthenuts.com. Here's another thing from Justice Kennedy's opinion. He says, quote, trial by military commission raises separation of powers concerns of the highest order. Imperative that when the military tribunals are established, full and proper authority exists for the presidential directive, does not weaken our nation's ability to deal with danger. To the contrary, that insistence strengthens the nation's ability to determine through democratic means how best to do what needs to be done. The Constitution places its faith in those democratic means. Our court today simply does the same. So the argument is that everything this administration has done that has thrown the Constitution into question, that has transgressed the Constitution and also transgressed the Geneva Conventions, has compromised our ability to deal with terrorists because we are no longer respected in the world. We can't form a decent alliance. We have unilaterally made ourselves look like the pigs that we are. And also, when you treat people like this, depending who they are, you're only generating more contempt and possibly creating more terrorists. On a lighter note, apparently, People who would drive with cell phones are just as dangerous as drunk drivers.
No surprise there.
I know, I'm starting to realize it myself. I've almost gotten like several accidents. Have you dealt with that?
Yeah.
But on your own side? I mean, have you found yourself?
Yeah, but I put it on the speaker phone. But, you know, that's not as safe either, you know? People in New York, you're outlawed from doing that. Here in L.A., of all places, you can still do it legally.
I know, it's crazy because everybody's on them here. I always use the headphones primarily out of fear of cancer. And, you know, if something that you're holding up to your head, it gets hot in a weird way after a while, and the burn you feel on your ear is not regular burny. It's kind of like there's a satellite in the air projecting rays into your head, burny. That can't be good.
Energizes the cells in your hypothalamus.
And creates cancers in your head. Right?
Makes you salivate.
Does it?
Yes.
Are you serious?
Like a dog. Like Pavlov's dog.
I never noticed that.
Drool, drool, drool.
I don't know if you're being real or not. If you're being
ding
serious.
Dong, drool.
Yeah. Hold on, that's my phone. All right, we'll be back in a second.
Put on your thinking caps and then take off your pants, because it's time for the War on Brains with Mort Milfington, next on this Armed Forces station.
Now he spends his night sucking down tater skins at Hooters, Mark Maron.
Oh, yeah. Hey, folks. Look, every once in a while, we bring you the latest news from the front lines of the 6-year global war being waged by the Bush administration. Here with today's dispatch from the War on Brains is war correspondent, Mort Milfington.
Dateline, Washington, D.C., home of the William Howard Taft Memorial Bedpan Swimming Pool. He was fat.
Big.
War on Brains continues, you wretched nation of Panglossian Japanates. For while you were busy immersing yourself in the riveting antics of Dane Cook, the comically deformed congressional minions of Bushland came out from underneath their toadstools and bridges just long enough to raise their 232 hooves in the air and bleat in a united front to end this nation's 25-year ban on offshore oil drilling. That's right. From New England to Alaska, our pristine beaches are vulnerable to the specter of thousands of ugly metal structures spewing out tons of nightmarish toxic sludge. But enough about Orange Julius. This is about the Republican-controlled House. For in using their innate ability to know what's better for you and your congenitally fat families, the Republican Congress will now make it possible for millions of American beachgoers to baste their egg-shaped bodies in the very same oil Governor Schwarzenegger furiously rubs on his mud-caked Hummer whenever he tells Maria he's just going out to the tent to smoke a cigar. Experts say the only silver lining to this vote is that it may result in a ton of primal splooge exploding onto David Geffen's Malibu Beach estate. As if there weren't already enough stupid dick jokes in this bit, the bill would also produce windfall gas and oil royalties for Louisiana, Texas, Mississippi, and Alabama, four states that normally vote like stupid dicks to begin with.
Yeah.
Yes. 19 billion barrels of recoverable oil and millions of square miles of poison coastline are the ingredients of George W. Bush's energy policy, his Xanadu. All this in a country that wastes 21 billion barrels of oil a day. Shameful. Most of that on Mary Cheney's vibrator. Bingo, dick joke number 4.
Woo!
Ignominious.
Ow!
So what's left for you, the ordinary average Joe six-pack disinterested voter, to do? Drive a hybrid SUV that gets 10 instead of 7 miles to the gallon? Recycle your Otter Pop wrappers? No. The best possible thing you can do is set up camp on public land, sand. The best possible thing you can do is set up camp on public sand in front of Barbara Streisand's Malibu Beach House. You know, the public beach she and other assorted showbiz moguls don't want the public to know about. Determine exactly where the property line is in the sand, and then place your foot in and out of her property until Marcus Wellaby's butt boy comes out and threatens you with a broom. Trip him over the property line so he falls onto the public beach. Then humiliate him by pulling his kitchen apron up over his head and beating his scrotum with the salad spinner he threw at you 2 hours earlier. Why go through all this trouble to bother Streisand? Because David Geffen's out of town right now. And rich people are always jerks, liberal or conservative. And so, Americans, if you still think you can help protect nature by doing something quaint like voting, go ahead. But remember, until this country becomes a democracy that isn't run by rich people, the best thing you can do for the environment is to beat James Brolin's scrotum with a salad spinner. And yeah, that's today's dispatch from
The War on Brains.
I think that's a tongue twister. I'm gonna give it a shot. Wait. James Brolin's scrotum with a salad spinner. James Brolin's scrotum with a salad spinner. It's not, it's not really a tongue twister.
James Brolin's scrotum.
James Brolin's scrotum. James Brolin's scrotum. James Brolin's scrotum.
Brolin's scrotum.
Brolin's scrotum.
Marcus Welby's scrotum.
Marcus Welby's butt boy scrotum.
See, well, that might work better.
Marcus Welby's butt boy scrotum with the salad spinner.
All this you can, if you want, come to my comedy class. I'll be teaching at the learnings annex. You'll learn more about writing that kind of joke.
I wonder how you get that job. I don't know if I could be very good at that job with my temper. I don't know how good I'd be at that. What? It's just not funny. You're an idiot.
That'd be bad. Yeah, but they're paying a lot of money. So you probably say, hey, that's pretty good. You need another course to develop more.
They must pay those people a lot of money, because some of those people are big people in whatever it is they do.
Yeah.
I can't imagine who goes to those things or whether there's something to learn from that. I've got to learn some new things. I've got to put new things in my head. Do you find that you learn things, like new things on a day-to-day basis or even weekly? Really?
Nah, not really, because I'm stultified at the moment. I learn new things when I go to open mics, you know?
Yeah.
And I see bad open micers and good open micers.
Yeah.
And you learned.
I just say, you need that nugget, that little thing that changes the way you think a little bit, that tweaks you. I haven't had one of those in a while.
A fix?
No, just like something that all of a sudden makes you look at something in a completely different way, a completely new way. I like those kind of things. You read something, it's like, oh my God, I never thought of that. And a little cavity opens up in your head, and it's like a new room. You just start decorating.
It's LSD. Right?
We'll be back, yes, with Joel Rubin from the LA Times.
Now he regrets loaning Limbaugh his Viagra,
yeah.
Mark Maron.
That bastard. Hey, folks, after my conversation with Jonathan Alter, as I said before the other day there, I feel like an idiot. He said that the teachers' unions were to the Democrats what the religious right is to the Republicans. He said it was about accountability and had something to do with state control over the schools. I still don't totally know what he was talking about, but there was a piece in the L.A. Times day before yesterday, maybe yesterday, about a state legislative vote in favor of L.A. Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa to have most of the control over the Los Angeles Unified School District. There are two sides to this, obviously, to the mayor having that kind of control. With us is L.A. Times reporter Joel Rubin to discuss these two sides. Thanks for being with us, Joel.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You bet. I don't expect you to agree or disagree, but I would like to. I'd like you to help me chart where some of this might come from. Now, for supporters of Mayor Villaraigosa's control of the schools, why is it a good thing?
The general storyline on mayoral control. Maybe we should back up for a second.
Okay.
The mayor had initially announced his desires to really take over the Los Angeles Unified School District, which is the nation's second largest after New York. As soon as he took office a year ago, he had said that he really felt like the elected school board was defending the status quo and not pushing through reforms, and said that he needed to be the man in charge, and had proposed ideas that would have really gutted the board.
What kind of reforms?
A mayoral takeover in which legislation or a public vote would have really just gutted the board or eliminated it altogether and placed the control of the school district in his hands,
mm-hmm.
and he would have had the power to appoint and fire a CEO or a superintendent that would have really run the day-to-day operations.
As opposed to, how does it go if he doesn't do that? They're usually voted in from school boards?
Currently, there's a seven-member elected school board who in turn hires the superintendent who runs the district on a day-to-day, but the board often gets its fingers into the nitty-gritty of the day-to-day and is often criticized for doing so instead of just taking a step back and being a policy body.
But, okay, so you're saying that if the mayor were to have this control, then they could initiate it without the kind of a confusion or debate around individual elected school board members and maybe, you know, put something into practice that would be a citywide curriculum or make choices along that level and have more accountability.
Well, right. The mayor's selling point was that somebody needs to be in accountable, and somebody needs to have the clear line of authority, and as opposed to a seven-member elected body that has to constantly run for election, and that's where the unions come in. The local affiliate of California Teachers Association, which is called United Teachers Los Angeles, was adamantly opposed to the mayor's call for mayoral control, and it was interesting because UTLA has been a strong supporter of Mayor Villaraigosa. Mayor Villaraigosa actually used to work for UTLA, and yet UTLA was obviously threatened by the idea of losing the ability to put candidates forward for the school board, and so was adamantly opposed to the idea of mayoral control.
Okay, so the reason that the unions were opposed is because the people that run for school board are generally members or perhaps teachers or former teachers.
Often former teachers or principals, but it was more that the union has a vested interest in being able to put forth candidates. They're very well financed, the union is, and can toss around some serious cash when it comes to campaign time.
So what do the critics say of this situation? Because I know there are people that say you don't want the school board that involved because of their political intentions that may not necessarily just be around protecting teachers, that their political intentions may be a liability to the quality of education and a liability to accountability. Is that what the critics say?
Right. They paint critics of the board, paint a picture of a sort of a cumbersome bureaucracy, a bloated bureaucracy that this board oversees, and a board that is political at its nature and is slow to push through reforms because they're afraid to put their necks on the line. The criticisms you often hear of local bureaucracies and political bodies.
Right.
Yeah.
What are some of these reforms that are threatening to the teachers union?
Well, the big issue, and maybe again we should say what happened. What's happened is the mayor, because he saw that he wasn't going to get his takeover without as long as the union was standing in his way and. UTLA and California Teachers Association, which is the statewide body, which is more powerful times 100 to UTLA, just given the scope of their reach.
Yeah.
They were both vowing to torpedo any legislative efforts with their sizable resources and lobbying efforts, and so the mayor struck a deal with the unions, with CTA and UTLA, and giving them a nod to what's important to them, which is, for instance, one of the pieces of this legislation that's being proposed, and we should note that it hasn't been approved yet. It just last week or just a few days ago made it out of an important committee, but has not been put to a full vote yet. So, and then would have to be signed by Governor Schwarzenegger. But so what the mayor did is give a nod to the unions, and the big piece of that was saying that he would give them more control over what curriculum is chosen at the school sites. We have an administration right now that is very set on sort of dictating what goes on in the classrooms, saying it's the way to make sure that everybody's accountable and on the same page, and that's driven the unions crazy, saying that the teachers should be in control. But what is also notable is that the reform or the compromise that the mayor agreed to keeps the elected school board in place, but with a much reduced role, but one of the roles that they do maintain is the negotiating the contracts with the teachers union. So you have a you would have a board that does some things with the school district budget, but really at the end of the day, one of the big things that they will do is still negotiate contracts with the teachers union, which was obviously in the interest of the teachers union.
And how does this affect? Okay, I guess another question is the teachers unions. You know, there's a tenure issue. There's an issue of protecting teachers' jobs,
sure.
And there's an issue of getting teachers more money. And also, I guess the concern there is that they will lose some of those freedoms, right?
Well, they want to be able to, obviously, benefits and pay are obviously front and center when it comes time to renegotiate new contracts, but also built into this, you know, several hundred page contract that the union has with the district are, you know, as you mentioned, protections for teachers. It's very hard to fire a teacher in LA, and I would assume in other big urban districts, because there are some real protections built into the contract, which critics say just make it nearly impossible to get rid of somebody, even if they're not a good fit for the classroom.
I think that's the big sticking point with some people, in that I think the critics on both the right and the left feel that, you know, if we are going to put an effort into making education better and providing better educational systems, somebody's got to be able to get rid of people that are not doing a good job. And I guess defining what that means is a real issue.
And people are already speculating about how that issue is going to be addressed in this new compromise plan that the mayor and the union have come up with. A lot of people are saying that, you know, the rumor mill and the sort of backdoor, backroom conversations are that the mayor has already told the union that they're going to have to address this issue, and that is something that's going to have to change, that it is going to have to get easier to fire teachers that are thought to be bad fits.
And what about charter schools? Where do they fit into all this?
Well, LA has more, I think this is right, but certainly it's a school district that has some of the more charters than most urban school districts in the country. It has now 100 charter schools. The union is adamantly, they've been very critical of the charter movement here in LA, saying that there's no obvious or no clear evidence that they provide a better education. They accuse them of, you know, creaming the best students off and say that, you know, the union president's favorite line is that charter schools are just private schools dressed up in a pretty new dress. And what's been interesting is that the mayor has embraced charter schools, saying that they're incubators for innovative new teaching techniques. And yet, as soon as he struck his deal with the union, there was no obvious love for charter schools. And in fact, part of the legislation would specifically says that one of the reform efforts would keep schools in the district and not make them charters.
Okay. Oh, that's interesting. So I guess that's really the wedge issue is how do we get the issues that cause the most trouble is, you know, firing teachers that are considered, you know, not a good fit, and also the existence of charter schools as opposed to, you know, providing what is needed to make the public schools raising their levels.
Right. Well, you know, charters obviously get the districts of the unions hackles up, given that a lot of them are ununionized, and efforts are underway, they say, to start unionizing the charters, but as of now it's slow going.
Okay, well, Joel Rubin, thanks for helping me out.
No problem.
You take care, man.
Bye-bye.
Bye. We will be back in just a minute with Mike and Patrick Henry from, they wrote the Family Guy, the Family Guy movie, one of them did, now they're kickedinthenuts.com. Kickedinthenuts.com, that's right.
And now he's smoking a pipe full of chocolate, Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. Did you meet everybody? You met everybody, Jim?
No, I didn't. I know their names.
I'm going to introduce them to you right now. A few Family Guy freaks. Mike Henry was a writer for the show and the voice of Cleveland Brown. Many other characters. His brother Patrick Henry, also a writer for the show. They both wrote the movie, the Family Guy movie. Stewie Griffin, The Untold Story. Together, they have become the proprietors of one of the more popular websites
kickedinthenuts.com. They're here with us. Welcome to the show, fellas.
Thanks.
Hi there.
This is Jim Earle, by the way.
Hey, hi, Jim.
Hi, buddy, Jim. Yes.
Nice to meet you.
So let's, for those of you who don't know, I went to kickedinthenuts.com. It's disturbing. And it is the logical end to what, you know, reality shows are. I think that it was only a matter of time before they get this focused. And it's amazing that people who get that kind of assault, what's amazing in watching it is how many of them are willing to kind of go, oh, I'm on TV. I mean, it's mind-blowing. What made you guys come up with this?
A few years ago we were taking meetings around town, and a couple of them were with these terribly invasive hidden camera shows.
Right.
And it was just, they went to such extreme to mess with people.
Yeah.
And, it was just our comment. Whatever goes, you know, whatever it takes to get on TV, most people will be happy to do it.
It's wild. There was a guy.
Go ahead.
And so we wanted to kick them.
Yeah.
See what how people would respond to that.
Yeah.
Like, would they still want to be on TV?
And, right. It's amazing how many people do.
Yeah.
And who's that guy you got doing it?
That's me.
With the wig.
Yep.
Oh, my God.
Mike Henry right here. I'm the kicked in the nuts guy, but do not kick me in the nuts if you see me.
Has anyone tried to?
We did a couple of public kicks in public areas,
yeah.
And one person actually came very close to kicking me. Just someone out of the crowd ran up and, you know, pretended to kick me, but almost did kick me.
Right.
And so public appearances are out of the question for that character.
Right, I guess so. But you know what's funny is how many there's that moment where you know you have to stand some of these guys off before they realize what's going on.
Oh yeah.
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 It's weird because I watched that show the Perverted Justice or whatever.
Okay.
Have you seen that?
I haven't.
Come on, man. It's demonic candid camera. They literally entrap pedophiles, and you got to see this show. They basically have somebody posing as a teenage boy or girl.
Right.
You've seen it.
I've seen these exposés, but not this particular show.
Well, what is it, 48 Hours or America Undercover?
Oh, right? Yeah.
What's Charlie saying? What are you saying? Huh?
Dateline.
Yeah, right.
Yes,
you've
I
seen
have
it.
Seen that. Yeah. Sure.
Because to me, on some level, that is just like the dark side of candid camera. It's like, hey, how you doing?
All right.
Like, oh, hi. Oh, no. Right. I was just coming to bring candy. It's amazing how many of those guys, their first response is like, I wasn't going to do anything. Or this one that's like, I'm bad. I'm wrong.
Right. Just caves immediately.
Yeah. But it is a type of reality television in a way. It's not particularly funny, but
right.
it's a type of reality television. Now, I was watching, I watched a bunch of Family Guys because my producer, my old producer, we talked to Seth MacFarlane once before.
Yeah.
And you still write for the show.
Yes, I do.
And you are as well?
Well, right now I'm kind of trying to get some legs for some other feature type project.
And how's the, how's that feature, the one that you guys did, pretty popular?
The Stewie movie was incredibly popular, and actually the two of us didn't, I mean, the whole staff wrote
right.
it, basically, but, it's amazing what happened with Family Guy with it getting canceled. They expected to sell 100,000 units of box sets, and they sold 3 million,
in
the first couple months. And
I wish that would happen with my show.
You know what? Just don't stop believing.
What's the? Oh yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
I'll try that. Yeah. That was oddly the one option I didn't check.
Right.
Don't stop believing.
Right.
I go right from like, we're in trouble. I guess I'll just go home.
Right.
That's the wrong attitude. So now, is it really written by manatees in a tank? Because I watched South Park and.
yeah. Is. Pretty much, we are mammals. If you do your homework, you will realize we are mammals. But I thought the South Park episode was hilarious when they We're basically busting our chops about having jokes that have nothing to do with the story.
Right.
And they just had Peter Griffin setting up cutaway after cutaway. And you think that's bad? Remember when I wore the salmon hat and met Gary Coleman for a lot? You know, like, I don't even remember what it was, but every time they went to it, they got us.
Yeah. And did you find that was done in with a matter of spite? Or do you feel like they are, do you know those guys, Matt and Trey?
I briefly met them once. But I don't know. When we first heard they were doing it, I was like, oh, man, you know, I don't know what to expect. But you know, there was a weird blend of almost respect, or at least, you know, taking into account that we are popular.
Yeah.
It was funny.
Yeah. And how many you do like four voices on the show?
I'm up to nine, but I do Cleveland Brown. He's Peter's black friend.
And I do old man Herbert on Chris's paper route, who would just love to get a piece of Chris.
And I do the performance artist, who shows up now and then and basically focuses on the more detailed type things in a situation.
Yeah.
And
I do the green thumb deaf guy,
who is never going to be caught. I got a new character called RJ, who is always about to bone his girlfriend when something happens, and then there's no way.
And he's Canadian, of course.
Yeah, basically.
And then I got another new guy named Heidi.
So there's a few.
Canadian too.
Yeah.
Now, are you the little brother?
I am.
Yeah. I got that feeling, that dynamic. Like, you know, there was that moment where you were laughing at him, like, I don't know, here he goes.
There he goes again.
Yeah.
Seen it my whole life.
Did you ever do stand up?
I did do a little bit. I was out here in the early 90s and just, I took the Judy Carter workshop right out of the magazine.
Yeah.
It got me going. I met a lot of friends who are still good friends that are still, a lot of them still do stand up. I did a little bit here and there in New York, and I hated it, you know.
it's frightening, isn't it?
It's just brutal.
Oh, man. Yeah, well, you seem to, you know, you avoided getting into radio, which is sort of, that can be kind of like, you'll be, because, you know, when you're as talented as you are in terms of voices, you're just going to be like, hey, it's John and Mike.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
oh,
and hey, Mike, what do you got?
Yeah, just me and my closet sound booth.
Yeah, wouldn't that be bad? When you do radio, do they do what I just did and make you do voices?
Yeah, and frankly,
I just realized, like, I'm guilty.
No, hell, I don't mind. I've been chasing glory for long enough to appreciate a little bit of it, so I don't mind pimping it out.
Cool. So, like, the site, let's get people to go to the site, kickingthenuts.com. You've got episode one up there.
And two.
Two up. We got a little merchandise going, some T-shirts. We're currently in production. We shot David Schools, the bass player for Widespread Panic, which is a dead band. They were at the Wiltern last night. We kicked him in the nuts during their sound check. We shot a bunch of. We've got a ton more that are going to start being released in the fall.
Okay, so it's sweeping the country by storm as well, isn't it?
3 million downloads so far. Yeah.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
Kicked in the nuts. Who would have known that would be so popular?
It's primal.
Have you kicked your brother in the nuts?
We go way back. There's a lot of stuff that's going on.
All right, well, Mike and Patrick, Henry, thanks for coming down. Kickedinthenuts.com is the website. The Family Guy is the show. The movie is the Stewie Griffin, The Untold Story. And you guys who are freaks for this stuff know who these guys are, and I'm sure I'll get blogs and emails like, dude, why didn't you ask him? Why didn't you ask him? Why didn't you? I didn't, and it's over. So we'll be back in a minute with Vic Garbarini.
All right, thanks for coming.
Yeah, thanks for coming.
Now, squirrels keep kicking him in the nuts. Mark Maron.
That's right. Little squirrelies. Get Pepitone in here in a minute. I feel bad he's out there waiting. We're going to give him a soda or something. Eddie Pepitone's in. He's worked up about something. Or maybe he's not. I don't know what the hell he's going to do. Last time I saw him, he was like, how about I do something like a calm one? How about I do like a calm one? I don't know. Our next guest, you know, if you've been listening to the show, he's been writing about music for years. He was the creator and editor of the Old Musician magazine. He was nominated for a Grammy for his interview with Paul McCartney. He's written for Rolling Stone, GQ, Spin, Mojo, music columnist at Playboy for 17 years. Right now, he's the American editor for Classic Rock magazine in the UK. The reason he's on our show is to talk about, we got a bunch of stuff at Vic's Picks. So welcome to the show, Vic Garbarini.
I'm glad to be here.
All right, man. So we're talking about today. We got three bands, new bands. I'm excited about this. We're getting fresh. We're getting new. Like, I know it was new because my wife's like, Wolf Mother. I love Wolf Mother. again, my wife is 12. All right. So the bands we're talking about are Arctic Monkey, Wolf Mother, and the Raconteurs. There is definitely a theme going out through all of these. This is the new, you know, kind of partially garage movement, isn't it?
Yeah, it's even more than that, actually. It's kind of a, each one of these bands represent completely unprecedented phenomenons in their own countries. the Arctic Monkeys, in England, Wolf Mother from Australia, and the Raconteurs, which is really Jack White of the White Stripes sort of side project.
In a real band, thank God.
But the thing is that usually when you get something like this, you go, oh, I see. They're sort of hammering together part of the Clash with part of the Carpenters, and the result is whatever, Joe Jackson. There's something different going on here. Each one of these bands is taking influences and melding them together in ways that create fresh hybrids that are, in some ways, more powerful from a lot of the stuff that they're drawing from.
Okay, well, that's good. So now what we'll do is we'll approach these pieces of music as perhaps a mouthful of wine, and we'll see what there are hints of and what the aftertaste is. Let's start with the Arctic Monkeys. I actually my least favorite, and their song "I Bet You Look Good on the Dance Floor." I wish you'd stop ignoring me because he's sending me to despair. Without sound, yeah, you're calling me. I don't think he's very fair. Your shoulders are frozen. Oh, but you're an explosion. Your name is a real, but I don't care for sound. The lights in the fuse might result in a bang, 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 bang. Oh, I bet that you look good on the dance floor. I don't know if you're looking for romance, bro. I don't know what you're looking for. All right, so now, Vic, I am getting a bouquet of pop, British punk pop, maybe a little bit of Joe Jackson, a little Fine Young Cannibals, maybe not Fine Young Cannibals, Buzzcocks, a little Buzzcocks, and maybe a hint of maybe a little Stooges, but not much.
And you're amused by its pretension, actually. The thing about that is, I'd agree with the analysis there. There's such an unusual story behind this band. They're basically four young guys from a small working town in Yorkshire, northern England.
Yeah.
Which, if you've seen Train Spotting and things like that, you realize is a ticket to nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
Much more so now than even when the Beatles started out in the 60s. If you think about it, think about England and Britain. This was a country that basically ruled the world for a couple hundred years, won the Second World War along with us, which was a Pyrrhic victory because basically they wound up completely broke with no colonies, and they still had rationing going on into the 50s. What's the one thing that the British had in the last half century that nobody in the world could touch? The Beatles, that's right, for 10 points.
I was going with a dental analogy.
Yeah, well, then, healthcare would be good, too, but the Canadians and actually everybody except us.
Right, you have that pop history, the invention of modern pop music to a certain degree.
And basically
degree.
The Beatles did that, and then we had all these English bands come over. But if you noticed, and I called up an editor in the 90s and I said, do you know that there have been no new English bands on the charts all through the 90s. It was about 97 or something. He said, that's ridiculous. I said, no, new English bands, look it up. And he said, my God, you're right, it's true, what's happened? In the 90s, the English came up with Oasis, which is to say, they wanted it to be the second coming. The English get obsessive about, we need another Beatles.
Yeah.
This cultural thing was our big thing with the Beatles. You know, that's our ticket to fame again. Where is it? And Oasis, of course, never quite made it.
All right, if we go at this pace, Vic, we're going to be still be talking about this band for tomorrow.
Okay, so let me sum up by saying, I don't think the single that you heard is the best song on the album, but I put it on because it's the best known. But this is a band who, before they got signed, before they even had a EP out or anything, were having vast crowds coming along singing their lyrics with them, just from stuff that was being word of mouth, people attending concerts, on the internet.
Buzz.
And the thing is, if you listen a little carefully to what's going on, they are literally almost poets, but poets for a new generation or new generation
okay.
of kids that are coming
right.
up. And they obviously are speaking to the realities of the life of kids in England.
Yeah.
And John Cooper Clarke is one of their main influences. Most Americans have never heard of him.
Yeah.
But he's been a very important poet since the punk movement there.
I'm glad we're wrapping this one up. Hey, listen, so it's I heard it.
Hold on.
It's got a lot of anger, a lot of drive, a lot of pop hooks. It's classic in its sound, and it draws a lot from the history of modern English music, and it rocks. Moving on.
Right.
Going to Wolf Mother Dimension. Here we go. I can't tell you. I just got a head full. What a bouquet that is! It started out with a little Jim Morrison, and then it sort of expanded into some Zeppelin, and then there's a little in the back of my throat. It got a little Sabbath, but it has production values of the Stooges again.
That I have written down here: Led Zeppelin, Sabbath, Stooges. I'd add a slight pinch of Spinal Tap, and perhaps a scattering of Sex Pistol in there too.
It rocks, though.
Well, that's the whole thing about it. Other bands like The Darkness that tried to put all the 70s stuff together sounded kind of fun, but you could tell that it had all been sort of hammered together. It wasn't organic, and it was ironic even if they didn't realize it was ironic.
Yeah.
These guys have taken all of this, and it's melded all of these influences, all of these bouquets, into an original wine, because... wine in either way you want to look at it. But the point is, as you said, it rocks. The energy when you put on any of these tracks just literally bowls you over. This is not something that's simply calculated and simple. This is, again, a new hybrid of stuff that carries this incredibly potent energy.
Excellent. So now let's go to the Rockin' Tours.
Okay.
Sorry, buddy. Steady as she goes. All right, see, now this is great, because I like the White Stripes' first two records, and then, like, you know, I mean, it's great that all of the Jack White's signature chord changes and lyricisms, and now he's, like, with a whole band. And I'll tell you, I was getting a little tired of the White Stripes shtick. They were becoming a novelty act, and this thing just opens up his talents and really fully rounds out the sound. And you hear a lot of, I think you hear some Beatles in there and some, and a little bit of Zeppelin as well, but there's something 60-ish, something more psychedelic about him, isn't there?
Yes, there is. And I think Jack White, even though he's known as like a punk blues purist, and again, another guy that, you know, when you see him with Meg in concert, even though people say, quote-unquote, you can barely play, there is a just an intensity that comes from someplace very primal and deep that is incredibly moving. I think the records, yeah, are getting a little bit jaded and so on. He got together with these people, and what you find out is, as you say, it's not just punk and blues in there. This guy loves the Beatles. This guy remembers the 70s and the bands he loved there. And he got together with Brendan Benson, another friend of his in Detroit. This is kind of a Detroit garage band supergroup. And the rhythm section from the Greenhorns, who are all guys who share these influences. And I think Jack is really just happy being a member of this band. He does most of the vocals, most of the lead guitar.
All right. Well, it sounds great. Hey, Vic, I love talking to you, man. We got to go.
Okay.
Hey, you did a great job. Great selection of CDs. I got to listen to the Arctic Monkeys a few times, but the other two, they're already in rotation for me.
All right. Hey, they're the Monkeys. Give them a chance.
All right, take it easy.
You too.
All right, bye. That was Vic Garbarini. We'll come back with Eddie Pepitone. Stay with us.
We'll be right back.
Now his rate changes are confusing the markets. Mark Maron.
Man, I was at the Friars Club last night, and it was a little rough, man. A little rough. It was a little rough, and it has an effect on me. It has. I was just talking to my friend Eddie Pepitone on the break. Who's in the? And you know, it's interesting. It wasn't me. It was a situation.
You're only as good as your last set.
I think that's true. But you know, Eddie used to be a reporter for us, and but you know, that may be true. You're only good as the last set. But
no,
I
don't believe that. But that's what people think.
Right? You say that metaphorically, but that doesn't mean that if the last set doesn't go well, you should be sitting there going, "I made the wrong choice. Can I still teach?" But look. Hey, Eddie, how are you?
I'm good, Mark. Well, thank you.
Well, it's you know, I notice you're a little reserved. Usually you come in here, we're all set to yell, we're all set to scream, you've got some reporting to do. But I'm surprised, as are many Eddie Pepitone fans going to be surprised, Eddie has leveled off a bit and has actually taken some an interesting initiative in political activism. It's an approach I've never heard. It's sort of, I don't know if you would call it decorating, but it's definitely reconceptualizing prison culture in a way. You're part of a group that brings. I'm not sure I understand. You go to maximum security prison and you switch it up a little bit.
Yes, we do, Mark. In association with Zagat's and Let's Go Maximum Security Prisons, there.
Yeah.
We are starting to get maximum security prisons online with some of the finer hotels. And the reason why I wanna.
You mean as nice as.
As nice as some of the final hotels.
Yeah.
For instance, you know, yesterday in the news was the tribunals at Guantanamo, and I am going to start trying to bring in certain things to Guantanamo that are going to make the prisoners there feel like they're at a nice place. For instance, I'll give you a couple of things. There's going to be entertainment. We're going to have, in September in Guantanamo, we're going to have Bonnie Raitt followed by Wolfmother.
Uh-huh.
We're going to also do a Pink Floyd laser light Koran concert. Dame Edna is going to be in there.
Uh-huh.
And this is all in Guantanamo. We're going to have spa stuff. We're going to have, and I know, you know, this is kind of funny, but we are going to have shiatsu, recce, and rolfing.
Uh-huh. Do you have an exfoliating mask?
We're going to do all that stuff. There's going to be Botoxing for some of the prisoners because skin tag removal. Skin tag removal, yeah. There's going to be dermatologists who come into Guantanamo and remove those.
Oh,
I mean, because they're eyesores. And now listen to this, Mark, and this is what I really want to do for Guantanamo, because I did this for a lot of prisons here in California, wine tastings. There's a playful Chardonnay right now that's making its way through Guantanamo, and we're going to, like, serve them with sweetbreads and just see if people can get a finer...
Sweetbreads, you mean intestines or brains?
No, sweetbreads are actually the larynx of the calf.
The larynx?
I believe it's the larynx.
Is that true? Is it the larynx?
I thought it was.
Do you have a butcher that does this? Do you work with a butcher? You have a whole catering operation?
Yes,
you have people you work with?
Yes, there's different companies that, you know...
I assume you'd be working with a Cuban company in Guantanamo that you...
Yeah, there are some Cuban caterers who, you know... Guantanamo is kind of an eyesore right now. We're also going to do outings for the prisoners. We're going to take them to Six Flags. There's Six Flags that's not far away. And let me tell you something.
Now, when you do that, do they have to wear the orange outfits or no?
You know, I really am not involved in that, but...
Because I would think that would make other people at the park uncomfortable. You show up with, you know, 10 guys wearing the orange outfit.
Six Flags Guantanamo is not really going to be populated with that many.
You're bringing Six Flags to Guantanamo.
Yes, yes, and Teacup Ride will be there. And also we're going to be taking prisoners to, like, the Museum of Tolerance.
This seems ambitious. I think they might close Guantanamo. That might be the best thing.
Well, I don't think so, Mark, because if we can bring these things to the prison, for instance, prisoners who are deemed to be relatively safe can have a pet. That's going to be something that we're going to try to do. Dogs, cats.
Yeah.
Also, video games. We're going to try to get Halo in there. Madden NFL 2004.
Oh, yeah.
NBA 2003. Yeah. And these are just some ideas. And we're trying to also get, you know, just some celebrities, like Parker Posey has volunteered to come over to Guantanamo and be at Guantanamo for like 3 days a month, because Parker is, you know, someone whose career is starting to take off and she's interested.
Is it taking off again?
Well, she's in Superman.
Is she?
That's what I was told.
I haven't seen Superman. Now, are you in business? Like, I know that... you know, it's Wackenhut, which is the prison chain. They're a security company, and they own many high-security prisons.
I've dealt with the Wackenhut people introducing wine tastings. into some of the California prisons. And they're, at first, they're not nice. I mean, I've gotten lazy. I got tasered and,
So you, wait, you show up with a truck and you
well,
go.
Well, I showed up.
I'm here. Do you say that? Like, I have wine for the people.
Well, yeah, I'm like, I got a Merlot that's going to knock your socks off. And, you know.
Watch your voice. You know, I don't like to hurt yourself.
No, because, you know, a lot of prisoners who are doing life love a nice Sauvignon Blanc, and Wackenhut has been very receptive to the Sauvignon Blanc.
I think what you should pitch is maybe a Wackenhut line of wines, like, you know, Wackenhut Vineyards, you know, it's smashed by real prisoners, the grapes smashed by real prisoners. Yeah, put that in your head, huh?
That's the idea.
I'm a thinker. Put that in your head, Eddie. You want
to... I'm going to call Wackenhut. Do you have a phone here, Mark? I want to call Wackenhut. Where's the phone?
We'll get one. Why don't you hang out? We're going to talk to Peter Horton. You know who Peter Horton is?
I know that name.
Yeah, he was in 30-something, and he used to own an electric car. Yeah, why don't you just sit in here?
Sure.
And occasionally laugh like that. We'll be back with Peter Horton on the phone.
Now he came down from Yellow Mountain, Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. We had the director, Chris Payne, I think his name was, in here before, the director of Who Killed the Electric Car. And I, as I said before, I really had no idea about California's electric car program. I wasn't living here when it was born and when it died. Who Killed the Electric Car is a very personal movie. It sounds like just another documentary about how big business destroyed something good. It is that, but it is more. Because people loved their electric cars. Given that they were not sold, but leased, and it was a bold new idea, when the forces that catalyzed the kill of the electric car came together, the cars were ripped from the caring hands of their owners and destroyed. Just shamelessly destroyed over time. Peter Horton, who you may remember from the 30-something TV series a while ago, and now he's a TV director. He directs Grey's Anatomy, a lot of episodes of that and some other stuff. He owned one of those cars. He appears in the film. He's with us on the phone now. Welcome to the show, Peter.
Thank you very much.
Hey, so, you know, it was very touching, you in this movie, and there was nothing a guy, even a guy like you, successful guy, got some cash, could not stop them from taking your car away.
Not even my two daughters driving around in their Barbie electric car.
There's a scene where you literally you watched them take it.
Yeah.
It's so bizarre to me that people that they had no power. That what was the agreement that they gave you? I mean, you were forced to lease it. Is that how it worked?
Well, when I first got into the car, got interested in it. They were offering 3-year leases at the most. They wouldn't let you buy it. That was never an option. Even though all of us pretty much asked if we could, that was just never considered. And in fact, when I finally got to the point where they were willing to lease me one, they came to me and asked if I'd be willing to take a 2-year lease instead of a 3-year lease, which again is a bit unprecedented, at least in my experience with
buying
corporations
cars.
And their products. It really was clear from the beginning this was a reluctant lease, let alone a purchase.
So, in retrospect, why did they do that? I mean, did they know that they were going to end up recalling these things? Did they know that the politics around the oil companies and state politics were probably going to win out, and they were going to be able to pull this thing off the market?
Well, yeah, they had a strategy sort of from the moment Roger Smith, who was the CEO who initiated the project back in 1990.
Yeah.
Shortly after he initiated it, he resigned, and from that point forward, their strategy was pretty much see if we can stall production and development of these things. And at the same time, do the best we can to kill the California mandate, which was put into effect after Roger Smith had announced his plan. And they basically were playing this game of the new way of saying no is to say yes, but this is difficult, and let's stall, and let's wait, and let's dilute the process until the mandate is weak enough that we don't have to make them anymore.
That was unprecedented in and of itself that a company would put these things on a market only really to destroy them ultimately.
Yeah, they you know, I've thought a lot about this because it seems so peculiar to me.
Yeah.
That a company would invest $1 billion into a project and then really of its own volition strangle it. And I really think it came out of like I said, the initial attempt was a good one, which was Roger Smith feeling like he wanted to put GM back on the technological cutting edge of the automotive industry. And shortly after he left, there was a mandate put into place. And I think the management at the time was both resistant to the idea of being told what to build, but at the same time, it really was in direct opposition to not only their corporate image of their product, which is a powerful muscle car that was big and could sort of climb mountains.
Yeah.
But also, I think their image of the country. I think it's all wrapped up into one for them. I don't think the electric car fit the image.
So you're saying that the mandate, which was at 10%, I think, or something like that, of the cars on the road in California would be electric by a certain time.
Yeah, by 2003.
By 2003, and they would have these electric filling stations, you know, that the state would set up, and there were some that were set up, that in some ways that represented something almost socialistic to them.
I think so, just from an image standpoint.
Right.
Because remember, most of the marketing of an automobile is imagery. It's selling an idea, selling a lifestyle. It's not really selling so much, the mechanics of it.
Well, it's interesting now that these hybrids are really they're marketed because of essentially that the lifestyle and the realities of climate change, of oil costs, of pollution have really made those things, you know, quite fashionable and necessary to a large chunk of the population.
Well, that's the great irony.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
Is here we sit, you know, now, gosh, this was all going on in the early part of the 21st century in 2000, 2001, 2002.
Yeah.
And here we sit in 2006, and what was being mocked by GM and other American car makers, which was the Toyota Hybrid, because they were convinced Toyota would lose their shirt on that deal, is suddenly the gold standard and becoming more and more popular.
Is that what you're driving?
Yeah. On the market.
I'm so mad at myself. I bought a Camry, and I should have bought a Prius or something.
Great car, man. I'm getting 48 miles to the gallon.
Really?
Yeah. And as you know, at these prices, that's really a blessing.
Oh yeah.
Anyways,
it costs $50 to fill up a car.
Oh God, yeah. I'm still spending $25 to fill up mine, and I do it twice a month. You know.
Do you think that ultimately what's going to happen is that there's going to be a full-on resurgence of the electric car? It seems that it's inevitable on some level.
Well, you know, coincidentally to this movie, and this is not by any design, but there is yet another crossroads for this technology. There is, you know, the California Air Resources Board, which initiated the initial mandate, is reconsidering it. In light of the gas prices these days and the demand for hybrid cars, and the fact that, you know, what's starting to come out now, Ford, I think, just announced, and Toyota as well, that they're going to, in the next year or two, offer a plug-in hybrid, which basically means you take a hybrid car and you plug it into the outlet of your house.
Yeah.
And for the first 100 to 150 miles, you get 100 miles per gallon.
Right.
And that's being sort of reintroduced into the marketplace, because the problem is, the other alternatives that are bandied about, especially by this current administration, like hydrogen and fuel cell and whatnot, are so distant and so improbable at this point, just scientifically, that they're not a real option for the immediate need.
Right. It's so. What's ridiculous about that is there's obviously some other business lobby around those technologies, because when you watch the film that you're in Who Killed the Electric Car, it's clear that the technology that was eventually evolved over producing the electric car is completely efficient and has it lasts a long time. It runs at a good speed. It's just the whole hydrogen thing stinks of corporate interest to me already.
It's wrapped up in the idea that we can again, it's a new way of saying no. It's saying yes, we
right.
want greener technology. Yes, we do understand the problems at hand, and our solution is hydrogen.
It's not going to be ready for 20 years,
and it just happens to be, it won't be ready for at least 20 years.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, you know, we have all of the petroleum that we can dig up out of the ground or pull up out of the ground, you know, in those 20 years, which is $1 trillion worth of business.
Mm.
And in the meantime, we can start controlling the hydrogen market. And so it's more than anything, it's an attempt, I think, by the oil companies to maintain their status quo over the long run, as opposed to addressing the, you know, which would be fine, by the way, if the problems we're facing weren't so acute. We've got...
Yeah, we might not be able to breathe in a couple of years.
Well, we've got some kind of a big issue with global warming looming on the horizon, not to mention the gas prices that aren't going to go down, which not to mention the problems in the Middle East. I mean, our problems are real and they're right in our laps, and the, you know, they don't happen to be in the highest interest of the oil companies to deal with them right now, but that's not the priority right now.
Yeah, there's only one thing to do, and that's avoid them in the name of money, the problems that we're having.
Well, that's unfortunate. I mean, you know, as long as we're living in a culture where market value is the only value, then you're going to have problems like this. But as soon as people can start flexing, you know, the values that they really feel are important to them, like survival,
yeah,
you know, and justice and things that are very patriotic, then, you know, we've got this standoff.
Yeah. Hold on a minute. Jim, do you have a question of any kind?
Yeah, were the plans for that electric car ever made public? I mean, is there any way someone else can, you know, make a version of that and start a business of their own with you know, backing?
Absolutely. And there's AC propulsions. There's a number of companies out there that are pursuing it. In fact, even in the film, I think the guy who made the first EV1 was a sequence with his new car that goes 300 miles on a charge and
yeah,
60 in 3 seconds or something ridiculous like that.
Yeah, and, almost could fly that car.
You have instant high power like a steam car.
It's an unbelievable experience driving it because there are no gears. It's truly a rocket ship.
And it must feel like almost like a giant toy in a way.
Oh, it is. It's not only all of the sort of moral and ecological reasons, it's also just an aesthetic pleasure.
Yeah,
I love cars. I really do. And I've owned some great cars, and this is my favorite by far.
Wow.
It's really, really great. And yes, there are people who are making them. The challenge is, you really need a large corporation like one of the main major manufacturing automobile companies to distribute them.
But all these companies rely so much on the dealerships making a lot of money on regular monthly maintenance on a real dirty engine. That's
right. Well, there's that challenge as well, which is why it has to be a combination of market demand and federal involvement. You've never had major changes in the automotive industry without some sort of legislation involved.
Well, maybe when everybody has trouble breathing properly and their skin is constantly sunburned, they might, you know what I mean?
When the sea level raises to 20 feet. Right.
When you're sitting on your beachfront property in Wyoming,
exactly.
Perhaps these things will be popular again. All right, Peter Horton, thanks for talking with us.
My pleasure, guys.
You take care, man.
Keep up the good work.
Bye, thanks.
Bye-bye.
Yeah. Okay, so that opened, that movie, Who Killed the Electric Car, New York and Los Angeles opened 2 days ago. Go see it. It's a great film. It's a touching film. We will be back momentarily to get on with the end of this.
Now he's comprised mostly of fat, siphoned off Star Jones, Marc Maron.
Oh, that woman looks weird, dude.
A lot of siphoning going on there.
Yeah, some people are built to be fat. I'm sad to say it. It's the way it is. And then when they lose, or maybe that's not true. Maybe if they were always look like that, you wouldn't think twice about it. But when somebody fat loses a lot of weight. You kind of like, that's weird. Remember when our buddy Jonathan lost all that weight?
You know? I don't think it was that extreme. I mean, no, you're saying that was...
It was extreme, man, because it took them a while. Like, people who lose weight, they're frightened to buy new clothes at first. So they're walking around with, like, the belt wrapped around twice and the baggy pants. It looked like, you know, Charlie Chaplin.
Yeah, but some of these people, when they have the staples in the stomach, then you get down and your skin is all like an elephant skin. It's all it's wrinkled and stuff. Like, where's the stuff that used to fill you up?
Yeah.
Then you have to have a special skin operation to tighten that up.
Yeah, what they do is they usually create a turnable knot on your back. That they just sort of like you can like you know when it starts to drag the, or sag a little bit, you just get your friend to twist it and it'll just pull the skin around.
What happens if that just gets loose somehow?
I don't know. I'm making it up.
There's a big rubber band around it in the back, or
it's like
a stick kind of holding it together.
Yeah. Like you know when you take the thing and you twist it and they poke a hole and they stick a stick in there.
Right.
Yeah, and then you just twist it and there's a clasp. That they surgically put on the clasp that holds it.
So you spin around like Curly Moe or something?
Well, that's the fear that, if you lose a lot of weight and the clasp comes undone, you could actually be propelled a few feet, and that's dangerous. Like, and depending where you are, it could be dangerous. That's one of the reasons why you don't see it much. That it's still in the experimental phases, that particular operation.
The skin knot.
The skin knot, which you can get in Thailand. Now, if you want it. And then you got to change your outfit because it sticks out a little bit. It's impractical. But if someone's looking at you naked from the front, mm-hmm. you look great. But if you turn around, they're like, oh, my God! What is that, a stick? Is that a skin knot?
Can you just cut the skin knot off and then kind of tie it together with sutures and then use the excess skin for a baby?
Yeah.
Make your own baby.
Yeah, maybe they should be thinking along those lines. Just go ahead and take it off. Cut it at the pull it up and then cut it and grab it and sew it up.
Yeah.
Hey, that's probably a better idea. I would think they would go with that one. I don't know why the hell they're doing that.
Then
first
you fill the excess skin up with the excess fat that was siphoned out of you.
And you make a fat ball.
Yeah.
That you can play with.
A fat ball.
Yeah, Indians used to play with fat balls.
Really?
Sure. There were games that they used to play where they'd take actual hide and fill it with goop and sew it up with some other hide string and kick it around.
There's iron in your words.
Yeah. What does that mean?
It's just Indian talk. This is how they used to talk to the white man in movies.
Yeah.
There's iron in your words.
Thank you. You speak
deer running in standing in road.
Your words are like stone in the truth that they spell. May the water run through you freely.
Huh?
Yeah. That means have a good pee, wise guy.
I don't know.
Hey, I'll tell you about that meeting I had later. We're going to figure out how to tell you about that meeting later, those of you who know what I'm talking about. Right now, it is time for you to be informed and not caught off guard. Yes, here we go. This is the short order news for today. Heavy toys could combat obesity. Researchers tested the effects of having kids play with heavier toys. They found that certain children burned more calories and had higher heart rates when they moved 3-pound toy blocks instead of unweighted blocks. Researchers suggest that by adding weight to familiar toys, children can get a workout without even knowing it, though none of the children were fooled by the Nerf shot put. Doctors removed a glass light bulb from a prison inmate in Pakistan after he said he woke up last weekend with it in his anus. Muhammad later changed his story and claimed his rectum had gotten a great idea. The U.S. Supreme Court strongly limited the power of the Bush administration to conduct military tribunals for suspected terrorists imprisoned at the U.S. Navy base in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Bush believes the detainees are cold-blooded killers. The detainees believe they are innocent victims of circumstance, and now they will settle their differences in the People's Court. Do I smell Law & Order Gitmo in the new fall lineup? Anybody? Do you smell that? All right, that's the short order news.
No more light bulb jokes?
Oh, yeah, let's have a look. Yeah, that's a good topic because, you're in the guy's ass. Doctors suspected Muhammad was not telling the truth when they found love letters he'd written to the bulb. According to the inmate, he was having a dream that E.T. was giving him a prostate exam, and the next thing he knew, there was a 60-watt GE in his poop chute. Gee, I think I picked the right one. Today, hamsters around the world... I'm not even doing hamsters. Is that the one you want me to do? No,
I didn't even read that one.
Oh,
I didn't
boy.
Know that one existed. Just the setup's funnier than the punchline.
Yeah, but you know where that's going, and we don't need to go there. Here's a classic twist on the setup. Doctors say the hardest part was removing the Tiffany lampshade. Hello. The Tiffany lampshade was also in his ass. Yeah. Okay, Monday and Tuesday, we are going to be gone. We are going to be meditating, ruminating, watching things aflame. Next week, we've got a lot of good guests coming up next week. I have their names here on my computer, but it's not coming up fast enough to make this happen in a reasonable time frame. Have a great 4th of July weekend. We'll talk to you Wednesday, sheeple. Let's play Fat Ball.